For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
I'm very happy that tonight Laurel Ross will be speaking. She helped organize the event yesterday. In addition to being the head doyen of Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and our fundraising committee chair, she's the urban conservation director of the Field Museum and knows a lot about conservation and nature and how that works in Chicago and the Chicago region. And so welcome, Laurel. Thank you very much for talking this evening.
Thank you. That was a very generous introduction. I would just say about yesterday, it was just a wonderful pleasure to be with those children during the time when the adults were sitting in Zazen. We took a walk down the street, and they just see stuff that we don't see. It was wonderful to just see the world through their eyes. So I'm sure I learned more than they did on the walk. So, and I want to say thank you to my friend Jerry for coming, my old friend from Chicago Zen Center. So this talk is about living in Chicago and being connected with nature and being a Buddhist. And I want to say it's about ethics, but I'm a little uncomfortable with that because I'm not a philosopher, and I know there's this whole scholarship of ethics, which I don't really know that much about. So I'm sort of using it in the colloquial sense about doing the right thing and living a good life. And
but you recently received the precepts, so
yes,
that is relevant.
Exactly. And so that's actually where this comes from. So my starting point is going to be about this book, though, called A Sand County Almanac, which is published in 1949, written by a man named Otto Leopold. And it wasn't noticed much when he wrote it, but it has subsequently become arguably the most influential conservation book for conservationists of my generation, and the people a little younger than I have greatly influenced by this book, sort of beating out Thoreau and John Muir and some of those classics. And Leopold was a Yale-trained forester, and he worked most of his career in federal agencies and academic institutions. And the end of his career, he was teaching in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin, and he bought a piece of land in Sand County, about an hour north of Madison, and that's where his family spent weekends and summers and holidays. He remodeled this chicken coop, which they called the shack, and that's where they lived when they were there. What they did, and he was a hunter as well as a scientist and forester, so they did hunting there, but their main activity was, it was a really damaged piece of land. He does not speak kindly about the previous owner in this book. He calls him a moonshiner and all kinds of things. He really did not like it, and because he abused the land that he owned, and then he sold it and moved on. So he had this land that was pretty much very degraded, and what they did when they came there was figure out how to bring it back to health. And they planted thousands of trees, and they planted prairie plants, and he was learning from the work that they were doing at the Arboretum at the university. And all of this is described in the book. And what happened to him during this process, I'm going to call an awakening. He doesn't call it that, but it sounds like that when you read it to me. He started thinking about the land differently, and he started thinking about the rights of the land. And when he said the land, he just didn't mean the soil. He meant all the parts of it, the plants and the animals and the trees and the water and so forth, the land as a whole. And he was asking, do those other parts of the world have rights the way humans have rights? And he pointed out that our ethical systems are are not static, they're evolving. It wasn't so long ago that people that we respect, and we always pick on Thomas Jefferson in this regard, but there are many people like him, intelligent, good people who owned slaves. And slaves were chattel, and you could do what you wanted with them. You could buy and sell them, you could breed them, you could abuse them, you could even kill them. They were your property, and that was just part of the way a lot of people looked at things. And that has changed. And he had this vision that those values could also change with respect to the land, and that our decisions about what to do with the land wouldn't always be based on economic considerations, which is the way most things are looked at even now. I mean, this was written in the 40s, so some things have changed legally with respect to land. We have wetlands laws and so on, but most things are still the same. If you own a piece of land, you can cut down the trees and you can pretty much ruin it. You can put filth in the water and you can do a lot of, you can wreck the soil and so forth. It's your property, and you could then move on to another piece of land and do the same thing. So he says, we abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. That land as a community is the basic concept of ecology, but that land is to be loved and respected is an extension of ethics. So his radical view was that spoiling land would be seen as wrong, even though it might be profitable. And he just proposed that, as he says, in short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community, to plain member and citizen of it. And it's way more complicated than I can go into tonight, but one of his strongest arguments for why that would be wrong is that it would be self-destructive, that by killing the land, because we are part of the land community, it's us and we are it. In the short run, it might be short-term profitable, especially in economic terms, but in the long run, we would be destroying ourselves, and there's really no future in that. So his summary of the land ethic about how to tell right from wrong is, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community, and it is wrong when it tends otherwise. So that, when I said this was a really influential book, that's what I'm talking about. And a lot of people are sort of basing how they think about the landscape in those terms. And I think that's wonderful. But what I wanted to talk about is how that doesn't completely work for us in the city. So most of us aren't really considering our decisions, our moral dilemmas, our moral decisions aren't about whether we're going to dig a ditch to drain a wetland, or, you know, we don't have endangered species on water on our land. And it's just not, it's good and it's right and we believe it, but we need to think a little more about how to act in the land, in the cities, because we have like different issues in complexity. So Tigan wrote this wonderful essay on Gary Snyder in his new book, which is in the back. We can't buy it yet, but soon. Anyway, he says, the bodhisattva path of universal awakening expresses insight and kindness in the particular mountains and waters in which we walk. So I'm thinking we walk in the city, so we need the bodhisattva path of in the city. So I was thinking about that, and then I got, this happens so often in life, I got this email from a friend who had a student at Yale. So Leopold went to Yale. It was just the centenary of his graduation from Yale School of Forestry, so they had all the students there studying up on Leopold, and they're having all these, you know, all kinds of seminars and so forth. And so I got this paper from the student that I've never met, but I really like him. His name is Seth Zarin. And he wrote in this paper, the environmental movement that Leopold helped give ethical voice to has struggled to join with organizations pushing for social and environmental justice, particularly for people in poor or minority communities. What use do inner city activists have for a land ethic built from farming, hunting, gardening, and hiking? Perhaps there are useful lessons, but at the very least, an adaptation and expansion based on the wisdom not only of the land, but of the street is in order. I just love that. So Seth did propose some ideas for an urban land ethic, and I'm going to read you some of his ideas, but I wanted to first read a poem by Gary Snyder, because he sort of had the starting point for the ethic for me. And this poem is called For the Children. It's in this really great book that I... it's like those Dogen books that Tygen does look really fat and you can never get all the way through. It's called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. It's many, many, many relatively short essays, and it's very good and very interesting. Anyway, Gary Snyder's contribution was this poem. The rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us. The steep climb of everything going up. Up as we all go down. In the next century, or the one beyond that, they say, our valley, pastures, we can meet there in peace if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and your children. Stay together, learn the flowers, go light. So, that was the start of my urban ethic. Stay together, that's about people. Learn the flowers. And we're so disconnected from the natural world in the city unless we really make ourselves not be. And go light. So I started a list, and I put those three at the top. And I used some of Seth Zarin's, and I took some from lots of other places. So I'm just going to read you my draft list of urban land ethic. And then I'd love to hear what you would add or subtract or whatever. So stay together, learn the flowers, go light, grow a garden, work for beauty, say hello to your neighbors and neighborhood shopkeepers and learn their names. That's one of Seth's. Volunteer to hold community offices and attend public meetings. Practice responsible ownership of a building or a piece of land. Seek out, appreciate, and nurture wildness in the city. Use walking as a form of transportation when you can. Keep your pet cats indoors. That's from the Audubon Society. Pay attention to what is alive around you. Feed yourself as ethically as you can. Seek out and nurture friendships. Write a song of praise and sing it in the street. For every gift you're given, give something in return, a planted seed, a suet scrap. Notice the moon cycle. That's from Tygen yesterday. Write thank you notes. Foster a culture of reuse. Live joyfully at each moment. That's from Kaz, who was here a couple weeks ago. And also from Kaz, smiling makes you happy. Value cultural heritage. Repair, preserve, or restore something old and beautiful. Encourage your children to be outdoors and play in nature, to climb a tree, taste mud, follow an ant, dance in the rain, imitate a squirrel. That's from those lovely children yesterday. Walk along a river and learn where it came from and where it's going. Volunteer at a food pantry or a literacy center or a park. Find out where your drinking water comes from and where your wastewater goes. Find out where your garbage goes. Feed the birds, keep a journal. So that was my list, and I actually made copies, and just not because I thought you would want to memorize them, but just so we could talk about it. But then just when I was done, I remembered John Prine, and he had a list too, so I'm just going to add him sort of as a postscript, because... and it's not entirely urban, but I love John Prine. I don't know if you know John Prine. He's a folk singer from Chicago. He had this great song, forget its exact name, but the story was he was driving along and he went into a bar or honky-tonk or something, and this topless dancer was singing this song that went, blow up your TV, throw away your paper, go to the country and build you a home, plant a little garden, eat a lot of peaches, try and find Jesus on your own. And knowing John Prine, he means Jesus in the most Buddhist sense of the word. So I guess the idea of this is not that we'd have this long list of rules that we would all follow, but Tigan was talking about the precepts, and the precepts are beautiful, and they encompass everything, but everyone has to figure out your own way of doing the precepts. I mean, they don't exactly tell you how to live your life every day, except in the most powerful and larger sense. So, like the I have the Norman Fisher version of the three pure precepts where you vow to avoid all action that creates suffering and do all action that creates true happiness and act with others all in mind. And to me, this list that I was trying to, you know, hammer out was trying to figure out how in the city we would avoid action that creates suffering and do action that creates happiness and act with others always in mind. So I made copies because I thought people might want that beautiful poem by Gary Snyder, and then on the back has that list. I don't think it has the John Prine part though, because I thought of that later. But I don't know if people want this. Thank you. I would just say one other thing. That I have two other books here that are, well, Practice of the Wild, of course. But there's another great book that you might be interested in, written by a great bodhisattva, Jerry Sullivan, who died about 10 years ago, called Hunting for Frogs on Elston Avenue. And it's a collection of his essays that he wrote for the Reader in the column called Field and Street. And he did that for quite a number of years. Every 2 weeks, he wrote a 2,000-word essay on nature in the city. And they're wonderfully entertaining and accurate. And it's a really fun book to keep by your bed and pick up and just read one every now and then. You'll learn everything from squirrels to bats to bees to birds to soil, etc. Fun book. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for a very rich comments, questions, responses, additions to Laurel's list of urban land ethics comments. Please feel free. Serena.
I have part of what I saw. Part of the song I can remember, I can't remember it all. It's kind of awesome. This guy's a dog from New York. I think it's still alive. And it goes, enough about human rights. What about slug rights? What about bug rights? What about whale rights? What about snail rights? And it goes,
snail rights?
All down to, down the food chain. And it's fantastic. I mean, the whole album is fantastic. That just what you were saying.
We should chant that sometime.
Yeah.
That would be fun to chant. What about bugs? What about snail?
Thank you, Serena.
Jerry doesn't know this because she comes from a Zen center where they don't do a lot of talking, but in this sangha, after someone talks, everybody else has to talk to it. Not half.
Just you and Sika.
It took me a long time to get used to it.
Well, what you were saying about seeing from Otto Leopold, seeing the land as community. I was talking yesterday morning about this in terms of Indra's net, and then that image of that Fatsang used to explain that idea to Empress Wu of building a room with mirrors all around it and putting a Buddha in the middle, and then he took her inside and she could see that there was a reflection in each of the mirrors, not only of the Buddha in the center of the room, but all the other reflections of Buddha forever. And I said that I saw a room like that in Northern California at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. But also, that's what our Zendo is like. We're all mirrors reflecting the Buddha. And I think that relates to, I want to relate that to what you were saying about seeing the land as community and seeing the land as alive, which is really a basic Buddhist or Zen idea that when we include all beings, not just, people, but when we apply ethics to the soil and the trees and the birds and all the species, we see this interreflectedness of caring and awakeness in everything. So I think what you said is beautiful and very helpful, and what the precepts are really about.
One thing. that I think about sometimes is that, so now at this point in human history on this planet, most people live in cities. More people live in cities than don't live in cities, and it's moving more in that direction. So it's really important that we learn how to live well in cities, because otherwise we'll fail and we won't have good lives. And we haven't thought that much about it. We're still figuring it out. They're still relatively new. We are not learning from past civilizations. I mean, people lived in cities a long time ago, but we don't know a lot of that. We've lost a lot of the wisdom. They used to know how to deal with water better than we do now. I'm only starting to learn a little bit about this. So cities are really important places for us to think about things like ethics.
Follow up on that, the cost of urban sprawl has been dramatically underestimated, and there's just this sort of view that you can just continue to push further and further out on any given spoke of the wheel, or at least till we run into somebody's boundary, and it doesn't work like that. It's just cost to put electricity out there, school out there.
And it gobbles up the land. It's just like the guy that moved on from the shack place. You know, he used it up and he moved, and we do that. We have brownfields in the city, and then we move out to the green fields and move farther out. Farther.
Jerry.
It's interesting because the more we move out, animals are moving back in. Mm-hmm. You see a lot more raccoons. I live like about half a block from the 1994 junction. There's raccoons in my head, there's wild rabbits, there's possums. I once saw a deer in a parking lot in a little mini home, and I was surprised, but I think they're like, well, too bad for you. We gotta go somewhere outside here. And in a way, it's kind of nice, to see it. It also gives me a much better appreciation for pigeons that everybody walks around and just hates, but boy, they are really, I'm talking about a city bird. Those pigeons can really, they are tough urban residents. You've got to have a lot of respect for when they get pushed around and jump this line and put up those little wires so they can't perch someplace.
Right.
They just shelter.
In spite of those, they're like, hey, move over. Just following up on Tom's observation about urban sprawl and thinking about the way in which our choices as city people sort of extend outward, and thinking about your third thing to go light, Gary Snyder's thing, go light, and what does that mean, and for people like us. And I know, for example, that the whole issue of eating meat tends to be a little controversial in Buddhist circles, because some do and some don't. And, but that is one of the ways in which the nature of our food choices in cities really dramatically impacts land, and in the most concentrated way, in the way meat is produced, and the kinds of energy that go into that. I mean, it's on a par also in terms of producing greenhouse gases with our poor transportation choices. And so diet is one way, and not to be preachy about that, but that's one way people can think, well, what are the impacts of how I eat? The other big one, of course, is how we choose to consume energy, and that would include transportation choices as well. And it's very difficult to go light in the city, in that respect. But, you can kind of work around the edges in the way that you suggest by, walking when you can. And,
I think it's easier in the city than it is in the suburbs. So I feel like that's a good. We're more compact, and we do have trains. And
we've got lots of potential, but I think it's underused.
It's true.
I was actually going to say, I think the city is the only place I can go. In Colorado, and everyone says, "Why did you move to Colorado? It's just beautiful." But talk about her. A lot of sprawl, that's all part of this. I used to drive 45 minutes to work, and since I've been here, I don't have a car, I walk and take the train. I've been living the most environmentally friendly life I've lived, and yet I rarely see, an animal or a squirrel, or so it's kind of this weird paradox. I miss those things about Colorado. I used to have foxes out in the back of my school. But I do think in cities where it's at, as far as living, we can do a lot better job.
Yeah, we can make the city nicer too.
Yeah. What was that? We had responsible ownership then.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of you guys rent anymore, but two last two places I moved into were just trashed. And
called True Dirt on
Farmer John.
Yeah.
And the dirt on Farmer John, and about this guy who owns Angelic Organics up in northern Illinois, and it's a fantastic film about this guy who almost lost his family farm, and then he started farming organically and then biodynamically, and got some good support from the Chicago community, and now is very successful, and they feed a lot of people, and they do it well. And so that's really inspiring.
Thank you. Yeah, just go ahead, Erica.
I just wanted to respond to Serena. Connecting with some of the other points in Laurel's things. I mean, obviously, you know, it's great if people can garden in their backyards or whatever, but there is a fairly entrenched and growing thing of community gardens. In Chicago, and my experience with those in sort of the Woodlawn neighborhood, there are two things that I think are germane. One, there's a lot of expertise there, and people can actually pretty much learn to do these things well with each other's assistance. But even more important than that is sort of seeing the way it really kind of, I mean, just speaking from my own experience of having participated in a couple of gardens over the last 12 years or so, the way it really sort of draws people out in the community. I mean, it puts a lot of different kinds of people in touch with each other who might not otherwise have any way to contact. It's really quite amazing. So. And I support, obviously, CSAs. I was a member of Angelics until I started, getting too much stuff out of my own gardens. But, so, I mean, I think they should be supported, but there are these other really interesting things going on, too. Yeah. Look into it. It's fun.
Yeah, so following up, I think what things you're talking about are important, and I think just the questioning that you're doing, Serena, about it is also important. And going back to Tom talking about growth and sprawl, I wanted to mention a book that I'm reading that I will be talking about here by Bill McKibben called Earth with Two A's. He's one of the great activists and scientists in terms of climate change and what's going on. And it's an interesting book because he uses Earth with two A's, because he says we're really in a new planet, that over the last 40 and even last 20 years, the physics and chemistry of this planet have changed significantly because of the effects on climate and so forth, not just climate. And so he spells all of that out and how things are going to be much tougher. And already, it's not something theoretical for our grandchildren. It's what's happening already with so-called extreme weather. But then he goes on to talk about, well, how do we adapt to the new reality of this planet? And he talks about things that a lot of you have been talking about, that we have to find a bioethic even of and an economical ethic that's not based on growth, which is how economists think of everything now, that everything has to be growing and growing, and Americans think of everything in terms of getting faster and bigger, and that actually we need values of steadiness and sturdiness and things that are down to earth. So I kind of feel like, in terms of what you were talking about taking care of our space, and what Josh was talking about too, that that's part of our Zen ethic, actually. How do we take care, to see, you know, this wider ultimate perspective, but then we apply that to how do we take care of this situation? And so, one can see that the coming really calamities and suffering caused by environmental devastation it's going to be difficult. But also there's this potential for changing the way people relate to the planet, that is, you know, and all the things you're everyone's saying is very relevant to that. So I'm going to be talking about that more, but I think I appreciate your talking about Otto Leopold and everything that everyone said.
I think that urge for consumption, it's like, comes from not having community, that you don't have satisfaction in your life that comes from something deep, like being part of a community. And so that's where I always feel like starting with the connection with each other. That's why Stay Together is so powerful to me, because you just don't need 7 TVs. If you got people to talk to that you care about, it's just crazy. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, Ben.
So I was trying to think of what I would add to this list, and I came up with something, and then I realized that it's already here. But what I was thinking was practice responsible citizenship and try to ensure that others are able to be effective citizens. And I did research in Brazil, and I spent a lot of time with people working on social justice and environmental issues in different parts of the Amazon. And it's very clear in that context that without effective citizenship rights, you can't also effectively protect the environment without a police force that respects people, a justice system, etc. And I think especially in cities in the United States, it's also very clear that the most heavily polluted neighborhoods, the neighborhoods with the least healthy eating options, are poor minority neighborhoods as well. And then as I was thinking that, I saw the verse 1, Stay Together. So of course it is on your list. I think just thinking about sort of the you gotta have human rights to have slow rights, you know? And slow rights should be part of human rights too.
Yeah, I always get really, really sad when I hear about people that working for social justice feeling like that's competing with environmental justice, because it's really not. It has to be the same thing. And people in the landscape need to both be working. It's not like, well, you have to feed 4 people before you think about bugs and bunnies. That's just a false dichotomy. That's just destructive and doesn't help. So, yeah.
I think what emerged in
poor people care about nature too,
for is that if you think about a natural landscape versus a people landscape, that's a false dichotomy. That the natural landscape has always been altered and used and modified by people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so you have to think about both, of course.
Yeah.
Thinking about the problematic
discussions.
One of the nice things about the San Camillo, and really nice to read, is when you write, you really get it, it's really. You don't hear and see that perspective much, but he really, when he writes, he really doesn't differentiate himself from the rabbits or the foxes or the land or the pine trees or, it's kind of like John Muir in that way, but it's a really interesting read because it gives you that perspective that you don't see a lot. It's not like he's writing about someone writing about nature. And you get that when you read it, he's writing about himself. Mm-hmm. It's really an interesting. Just for that perspective.
Yeah. Tom, with the urban sprawl, I was just thinking of friends that live out in St. Charles and further west. There's like a future shock that's actually present time for them, where their real estate taxes have tripled. I mean, they're just outrageous. And the problem is, and it's very true in Texas and places where there's even more land, is that when these things sprawl way out, there's no marginal cost attached to that development. And that becomes a discovery later on as those taxes and to support the non-infrastructure out there, you know, go up by a factor of 500%. The problem is that the decision to put that there left like a wake of decrepitness towards the center. This would be, I mean, this is Dallas that's in my mind, but other cities. And as this thing goes out, if there's like a wave of just, you know, falling down, stuff that ultimately has to be ripped down. It's a disaster. Because, and then you have the worst of both worlds. You have something that's way out, that's totally energy stupid, okay? And you have this desolate stuff that was more towards the center that is difficult to know what to do with. It's just the marginal cost of that sprawl is made like a mystery. It's just never, there's nothing that is attached to it. I don't think they would do that in Japan, or they would, or Berlin or somewhere. I'm just guessing. They might do it in China.
Eric.
So we have this Song of the Precious Jewel near Samadhi, and there are these lines at the end of it, you know, that I've sort of choked on a few times. Ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial. It's not filial. Failure to serve is no help. And, you know, it's very, very sort of futile. And you know, I won't try to sort of make judgments about how it functioned there, but I think about, well, what's the, you know, what's the sort of model that's held up, at least, if not always sort of realized, that's held up in our society? And it's precisely what Ben mentioned. It's effective citizenship. You know, and I think this goes directly to, you know, there's another sort of controversy in Buddhist circles about whether, you know, you should be quote-unquote engaged or not, or whether you should just be sort of cultivating whatever people cultivate when they're cultivating it. but, you know, but I think this idea of, you know, effective citizenship is really important. I mean, in any term, certainly, you know, in the broader sort of societal terms, and personally, I believe it's, you know, crucial to how we think about living in the world as Buddhists in North America in the 21st century. And I think that the sort of basis for that, or part of the basis for that becoming even possible, is sort of getting, overcoming this sort of atomization that our society fosters. And, you know, just sort of going back again one more step, this is why I think things like what I've experienced in, you know, community gardens, and there are all kinds of other modes to achieve it. Because to your first point, it's less stay together at this point than maybe get together. And it becomes, you know, I've sort of seen things that have happened in my neighborhood that haven't happened in other parts of the city. And I really think that the basis of it is that people, you know, certainly not everybody, probably not even the majority of people, but people really know each other, and they talk to each other, and they can leverage that into sort of effective interactions, for example, with City Hall. I mean, it works more sort of very locally than at the national level, but I think the principle holds, you know. I think that's really important. Like, you know, maybe it's even... even if it's implicit here, maybe it should be explicit on the list.
Thank you. This has been a great discussion and a great topic, Laurel. Does anybody have one last comment to make? Yes, please.
I just thought of this. I think it was the Leopold quote where he talks about wildness. Mm-hmm. And what I think is sort of magical about Chicago, that could be on this list in some fashion, but it's the lake.
Mm.
You know, if to be reminded of the wildness, mm-hmm, in which we are a part, we only have spinning seasons by the lake, and it's a poignant reminder for me. And I was glad that you had that quotation because it sort of reinforced that. So thank you.
Yeah, Leopold's like Dogen. He's very, very quotable.